You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Could you briefly explain what the Smith and Fonterra decision was about and what a strikeout decision is for our listeners?
Mike Smith, who's an iwi leader with customary interests in Northland, has sued seven large corporate New Zealand companies, including Fonterra, Genesis, New Zealand Steel, Z Energy and some others. And he says that their activities contribute to the climate change effects, which are damaging his whānau and iwi's land and their natural resources. He says that their contributions to greenhouse gas emissions are what's called civil wrongs to him, or torts to his family and his tribe, and that the courts should do something about it. This is a little different from the many other climate change cases where people are suing governments. This is a direct claim against corporates, and it's using private law, tort law, which is a little kind of unusual or distinctive. Mr. Smith lodged his claim back in 2019, and the corporates went to the High Court asking the High Court to stop the case at the outset before they had to go to the trouble of filing evidence and preparing argument. And the High Court agreed. It said that two-thirds of that claim should be what's called struck out, went to the Court of Appeal. The Court of Appeal struck the entire case out, and Mr. Smith appealed that decision to the Supreme Court, which last week said that both the High Court and the Court of Appeal were wrong to strike out the claim, that Mr. Smith should get his chance for his day or his weeks in court, and that the court should hear full evidence and make its decision on that basis.
What are the possible implications of the strikeout, both for climate justice and developments in the common law?
So the immediate implication is that Mr. Smith now gets a chance to run his full case in court, and he might not win. He's got some pretty serious evidential and legal challenges to overcome. One of the biggest challenges will be to convince the court that the contributions to emissions of these seven companies makes a real or a detectable difference to the damage and the harm to Mr. Smith's land. And to put this in perspective, New Zealand's overall national contribution to global emissions is a bit under 0.2%. So these companies only have a share of that. So Mr. Smith's lawyers and experts have to convince the court that the company's share of what's about 0.06% of global emissions is enough for tort liability to kick in. There's no real argument that Mr. Smith's land will be affected. We've already seen in New Zealand with Cyclone Gabrielle, and overseas, climate change is having significant effects. But because of its nature, climate change is a result of literally billions of sources of emissions. It's quite a challenge to sheet home legal liability using tort law. But Mr. Smith hopes that the court will look at these old legal rules and say we need to update the rules for tort liability to reflect global phenomena such as climate change. And maybe the court will change those rules. But, you know, even if Mr. Smith doesn't win, perhaps this is a climate justice and a tactical dimension to the case, it will require Fonterra and Genesis and New Zealand Steel to put their witnesses before the court and those witnesses to explain exactly what they're doing or not doing to address climate change, to be cross-examined by top lawyers and for their positions to be tested in court. So the pressure to be brought to bear on these corporates will itself be, you know, quite significant, and that will potentially have an influence on their reputations and their activities, even if I say Mr. Smith doesn't win his ultimate case.
What is your opinion on the orthodox argument that tort law court cases cannot adequately address climate change?
Yeah, so the corporates say that climate change is an issue which is so complex and so politically charged that it's best left to governments and to parliament, not the courts. Now, and it's true that climate change is, and climate change policy is hugely multifaceted. The government has to think about a lot of things. It's got to balance a lot of conflicting considerations. But, you know, I think the corporates or their lawyers, they over-egged that part of the argument. They said that the courts should have no role, at least in relation to tort liability, that they should step aside completely. The Supreme Court disagreed. It said, well, you know, for some other issues, Parliament has made it clear that tort law no longer applies, and the accident compensation regime is a great example of that. But Parliament has not legislated away tort liability in relation to climate change. And so the Supreme Court says, well, maybe the courts can offer remedies which can support rather than undermine the responses that Parliament has put in place with the emissions trading scheme and so on. And I think that position of the Supreme Court has some real force to it.
What is the significance of tikanga Māori being an essential part of this case? What does it mean both for the evolution of tort law and for climate action?
So in recent years, the courts have recognised this body of Māori customary law and practice and values, tikanga, as the first law of New Zealand that wasn't displaced on colonisation. And tikanga is relevant to how tort law might apply here, because Mr Smith will argue that the kind of damage to his and his whānau's land and resources, it has dimensions to it which are different to conventional Western understandings of damage. I'm not an expert in tikanga, and so I defer to Māori lawyers such as Natalie Coates, who argued this point for Mr Smith. But the Supreme Court acknowledged that Mr Smith, he's not just suing in his own right, but he's suing as kaitiaki or kira, both physically and spiritually, for the whenua and the other taonga that will be affected by rising seas and temperatures. And so this layer of tikanga could affect the way that the old tort law rules are understood and applied. They might affect the way that rules for causation and relationship are developed in the court. It gets pretty technical. But these are the sorts of things that the Supreme Court said should be argued at a full trial and not tried to be sorted out without the benefit of evidence.
Where does judicial development sit in the overarching structure of climate action? As in, how would judicial development advance climate action?
We've seen over the last 5 years a massive increase in parties going to the courts to seek some assistance in responding to the existential challenges of climate change. And overall, the courts are becoming increasingly willing to consider, in some cases, develop, you know, really innovative judicial responses to climate issues. And areas which in the past may have been no-go in the courts are not necessarily no-go now. It's happening in domestic courts, and it's happening at the international level as well, with a number of really significant court proceedings being brought, including one that New Zealand is involved in, before the top United Nations Court, the International Court of Justice. So climate litigation is a thing. It's growing in significance, and it is a really significant part of climate action, which sits alongside traditional lobbying of parliaments and the development of statutes and regulatory responses.
What are the possible worldwide implications of this case?
Judges are always looking at what their fellow judges in other countries are doing. And New Zealand judges do that. They take into account decisions from Canada, from the UK, etc. New Zealand court decisions are well respected overseas because they're usually carefully argued. They're usually really well reasoned by smart and thoughtful judges. And so what happens in New Zealand might be picked up overseas. Now, at the same time, each country has its own characteristics. And tikanga is one of the distinctive characteristics of New Zealand case law, which might mean that the distinctive New Zealand approach, you know, might not be able to be transplanted directly, say, to the United Kingdom. But there's definitely a lot of an international interest in this case. Perhaps the New Zealand courts will develop some innovations which will then be translated to Australia, to Canada, to elsewhere. We won't know until we see the outcome of that substantive hearing, which will now take place in the High Court.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.